something that I did to help me get some practice for an internal podcast that I was starting at my real job at LiveTiles. With no real training in anything to do with podcasts, it didn't stop me having a crack. But I knew that if I wanted it to last, I needed to do a decent job of it. My thoughts were, if I was going to dedicate so much time to producing these practice episodes, it should be about something I love. And so the Beer Healer interviews began. 100 episodes later, and guests joining me from all around the globe, hopefully I'm doing my bit to share the craft beer gospel. As usual, if you want to help me build this thing, Apple Podcasts is the place to do it when you subscribe, rate and review on that platform. When I began thinking about who I wanted to invite onto episode 100, Garage Project was the first crew that came to mind. I mean, whichever side of the Tasman you're from, if you're a craft beer drinker, you pretty much love what they do. How do I describe Garage Project? Cool, edgy, boundary pushing. From humble beginnings, they told stories with their cool can designs, and they captured the hearts and minds of drinkers everywhere. I've been chasing these guys for a little while now, but it wasn't until my mate Paul Barker from Brick Lane put a call into Joss that it all came together. How good is the beer industry? So much to talk about, so many stories to explore. So welcome to the Beer Healer Interviews 100th episode, Joss Ruffle and Pete Gillespie from Garage Project.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
The pleasure is absolutely all mine, gentlemen. Really, really excited, and it's very humble to get you guys both on. So thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Where should we begin? I'm thinking we should at least touch on, you know, how it all came to be. You know, it's almost 10 years now. There's three numbers that spring to mind: 50 litres, 24 beers, and one small garage.
And it ended up not even being 50 litres, to be absolutely honest, most of the time. I'll start off, Joss.
Sure.
So I'd been trying to set up a brewery in Australia in the Blue Mountains, and I'd been trying, while I was working at the Malt Shovel in Sydney, been trying to do that for probably about 3 years, I think. And the bureaucracy was just so diabolical that, you know, I kept trying to think outside the box, but for the bureaucracy there was only box. There was no outside the box. And it was just so frustrating. Came very close so many times. But in the end, I was really starting to feel pretty frazzled and burned out. And I went for a trip over to Wellington to visit my brother and, you know, bumped into Joss as well. And it's all just come from there, really. I mean, Wellington is a fascinating place. At the time, I think 57% of all the craft beer in New Zealand was being drunk in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Was being drunk in Wellington, just considering the size of Wellington is pretty remarkable. Is that right, Joss? That's roughly the number, isn't it?
Yeah. Wellington's always been a craft city.
Yep.
But, you know, we were drinking a huge amount of beer, just making absolutely none of it.
There were no breweries at all.
Yeah.
We had a small brewery on the waterfront that Lion had under their Max label.
Oh, yes.
But they, I think about 2010, they decided to pull it out, relocate it to Christchurch so they could create more space for a conference venue.
I'm sure I went to one in Auckland as well.
They have a venue up in
they're probably everywhere, aren't they?
But you know, it was just crazy to us that, you know, they would pull out a brewery in the heart of Wellington.
The one and only brewery in the heart of the craft capital of New Zealand. Why would you relinquish that ground? So I was working at the Malt Shovel at the time. So that's part of the Lion Empire.
Hey, mate, before you go any further, I came from Lion too and spent a lot of time with Chuck.
Oh,
have
fantastic.
You got a Chuck Arne impression?
Oh, my God, I couldn't do that. That'd be terrible.
Ruby Mahogany or something.
Oh, the window panes are – that was such a good line. Oh, my God.
How does
the porter go with that brownie? Oh, we used to love that one, the porter and the brownie at the end. Chuck is an amazing character. And, you know, I think no matter what, the craft scene in Australia owes a huge amount to it.
He's
incredibly clever and quite a remarkable character. And geez, he looks bloody good in a pair of budgie smugglers.
Oh, the swimming, he loves it.
Oh, my God, the slightest excuse just to, like, get into his budgie smugglers. I remember walking up to the upstairs at the Malt Shovel one day, and he's lying there reclining on a pile of malt snacks in a pair of bright red budgie smugglers with a glass of cold beer, and somebody's taking a photo of him. I was like, oh my God.
No.
It was tasteful but provocative.
Oh, wow. What a tip of the cap.
to Chucky. He was fantastic. I learned so he started my craft beer journey at Lion, and
yes,
I've got a lot to be thankful for him. He's passed on a lot of stuff, and a lot of brewers have come out of the malt shovel.
Absolutely,
they've gone and do great things everywhere.
Absolutely,
so yourself
very,
included.
Very clever, very clever person. So anyway, I was at the malt shovel and heard that Lion had pulled the Max Brewery out of Wellington, and I was just like, what? Why would they do that? And so that's really probably the catalyst for this, is just that power vacuum. Oh. The power vacuum in Wellington, I just sort of thought, bloody hell, you know, what an opportunity. So came over, hung out with Joss. Joss and I just went around all of the craft beer bars, and I almost felt like it was a trap. Like, why were there no breweries? Mm-hmm. You know, there had to be a good reason for it. So Joss and I just went around and we're like, why? Why are there no breweries?
Yeah, it sort of felt like there was a massive reason why there weren't breweries in Wellington that everyone else knew except for us. and for quite a while, I think, even once we'd really got going, we were sort of, you know.
Just waiting for the trap to spring and for us to find out why there weren't any. Other than the fact that there aren't many industrial spaces and real estate's pretty fucking expensive. That's probably the only real reasons. I mean, council was super supportive. Customs and Excise was supportive. So, you know, end of the day, when we actually, you know, decided to go ahead and do it, you know, within 6 months we had something up and running, which was...
So whose vision was it that said, I can take that ugly fucking petrol station and make a brewery out of it?
I think when Joss and I went to that petrol station, we just knew that was the spot.
It had a vibe.
I mean, you've got to actually put it in context. So it's in a very characterful part of Wellington. You know, anyone who's actually visited the garage will know it's in Aro Valley, which, you know, in the 70s was a real kind of hippie suburb. There's a lot of kind of like illegal builds tucked up in the kind of bushy little valleys up the back end of it. I mean, it's quite gentrified now, but it's still got a lot of character. And it's quite a productive little community. You know, there's a bakery, there was a coffee roaster, a guy producing, you know, wooden furniture. So it, more than just a place where people go and sleep at the end of the day, it was a real productive little place.
Yeah, I think for us as well, we wanted the brewery to be in the heart of the city.
Yeah.
Yep. We didn't want to be tucked away in an industrial estate. You know, Wellington's sort of brewery at the time, I think sort of the brewery that sort of saw Wellington as its home was Tuataara.
You know,
but they were making great beer, but they were over an hour and a half up the Kapiti coast. And I think, you know, we really wanted a place where people could come to it. They could see the beer being produced. They could experience that theatre. They could smell it. They could taste it, and not be tucked away.
Who's that?
That's not me.
That's Scotty from Bolter, actually.
Jimmy, you got bigger fish to fry.
He needs 100 kilos of malt and freestyle.
There you go. There we go. Joss is absolutely right. It's we wanted that theatre, you know, because there is. I mean, when you see brewing happening, you know, I mean, the steam and smells and. Yeah, it is. It's very visual. So, you know, we wanted people to be able to see that because people couldn't. There wasn't anywhere where you could go and actually see beer being made. And so, you know, if you've ever been to the RO site, you know, if you pop into the sort of cellar door there, you know, the brewery's right there. You can see what's happening. You can hear the brewers swearing. You can get sprayed with a hose. Nice. Anything can happen.
Occasionally take a barrel bung to the gut.
Barrel bung there. We had a barrel pop its bung one time and it went off like a rubber bullet and ricocheted around the cellar door and just about took someone out. It was
shit.
It went straight into someone walking into the cellar door. and it was cherry bomb.
Yeah,
as well.
There we go.
Cherry bomb. Song. So, I mean, obviously you cleaned up the petrol station. There was a lot of history. It wasn't just a petrol station, from what I understand. There was some sort of like ties to racing and that sort of thing, which obviously led to some of the beer namings and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you cleaned it up, you threw in a 50-litre kit, and then you just thought, oh, let's have a crack. I'm going to say it's very Aussie, but it's also a very New Zealand thing. Let's just have a crack and see how we go. Is that sort of how the next step happened?
I think we were just very aware that there were a lot of really good breweries already in New Zealand. Like even at that time, you know, for a country the size of New Zealand, there were a lot of breweries per head of population.
Oh, for sure.
Making very good beer, but very, you know, straight down the line, true to style beers.
Safe, would you say?
Safe. Safe, but good. And I mean, we just felt, we felt like, why the fuck would we want to try and just do the same thing as everyone else? You know, for it to work, we felt like we needed to do something, you know, a bit different, you know. I mean, it sounds a bit cliche, but something a little remarkable.
You wanted to disrupt a bit.
Yeah. And also, look, I mean, I enjoy mucking around a little bit and having a bit of fun. I think beer should be fun. Like that's the thing. I mean, I think that's so. What draws all of us to beer, isn't it? It's really fun. You know, I mean, wine, you know, I'm sure it's delicious. But I just don't know if it has that same sense of fun that beer does. And I think that's what's always drawn me to it. So, yeah, we did the 24-24, which was basically 6 months with a brand new beer being released every single week, which was shit scary, to be honest.
Yeah,
I have to say, though, I think we're beating that record at the moment. We've already done 52 new beers.
Oh, yeah, but you're cheating now because you got multiple sites, so you're cheating. out of one brew kit, that's pretty impressive. Yeah.
I think it definitely shows you how things have changed so quickly. Well, I say quickly, it has been 9 years, but, you know, I think at the time I wanted to see the sort of excitement and energy coming out of beer in New Zealand that I was getting to experience up in the States on my travels.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I think probably for you, Pete, I remember you saying it was almost a bit of an antidote as well from the few years working in a bigger brewery.
Mm.
But, you know, I think practically we couldn't afford a larger brewery, but we didn't want to wait and we didn't want a contract brew. So we decided that, you know, if we brought a brewery that we knew was not going to be viable whatsoever, but it would allow us to take those risks and be prolific and hopefully create something that would actually get some excitement and sort of give people a new experience. And, you know, at the time, breweries would maybe come out with one or two new beers a year, if that.
We thought of it as really like almost a guerrilla approach. Do you know? Even when we talked about this and we were like, even if it fucks up, we can kind of disappear back into the mist. And then kind of, you know, have another go in another form almost. So, you know, it did, gave us a lot of freedom. Were you about to ask how many of those original 24? Quite a lot of them.
Live on.
Yeah, Pernicious Weed. Pernicious Weed was in there. Got quite a few.
Happy Days.
Happy Days in a very different form. That beer transformed quite a lot. But yeah, Arenoir, Day of the Dead. Managed to pop in there.
I wasn't sure because you've got so many beers, but you mentioned one of my favourite beers of yours, which was in the original 24, which is the Pernicious Weed.
Yes.
And it leads me on to the great names and stories that adorn your beers. I've a couple of examples, Ziggy's Carrot Cake, Little Red Rye, Lola, and then more recently, Talk to the Hand, Surrender to the Void, Age of Aquarius. Was that storytelling side of the brewery something that you really wanted to embrace from the start?
Absolutely. I think every beer should have a story, you know? Like I think I enjoy storytelling and I feel like for me it's part of the whole. So, you know, I think you approach a beer, I want people to be drawn in by the name. I want them to be intrigued and, you know, drawn in, look at the can or the bottle and be even more excited. You know, the art should sort of speak to them as well, and then pick it up, turn it over, read the back of the blurb and find out more. And I mean, by that point, you should be at absolute fucking fever pitch excitement. Crack it. And then, of course, the most important thing is that the beer inside lives up to everything that you have, you know, teased people with. That's crucial because people aren't fucking idiots. If, you know, if the beer doesn't live up to it, it's just a stunt. But if it does, if it does live up to everything else, then what you've got is this lovely holistic package, which is just an experience. You know, it's more than a liquid, it's an experience.
Preaching to the converted here, because I also believe storytelling is part of the whole experience, because I also believe that the best beer you've ever had isn't necessarily the best beer, because it might be something to do with the people you were with.
Absolutely.
Or the place that you were drinking it, or, you know, maybe the what you're talking about with the storytelling. Liquid for me is just, as you say, one part of the puzzle.
An important part, absolutely. But yes, a part, yes. Yeah.
Obviously, the storytelling is a huge part of what you do because you've got the book. And I could just literally throw out all of my other questions here today and just talk about what I've seen from the book because I don't have a copy of the book. It's been sold out.
What?
Maybe if you do well, on your website, I went to check it out and it says sold out.
Mark, we'll have to find you a copy. I'm sure there's one somewhere.
Yeah. So it just was such a journey for me this past week or so where I sort of started to research some of the beers that I hadn't drunk. And then obviously that led to the bedtime stories videos, Pete, that you did during lockdown. Like so simple, so unique though. You know, no offense, but low production value. Just you in front of a camera reading from the book. But my God, they were just so engaging, and I just love that side of things.
Yes, that was good fun. I mean, that was born out of that kind of like COVID lockdown. I think everything was a bit lo-fi at that point, wasn't it? But yeah, that was good fun.
One of my favourite lines: "Are you sitting comfortably?" Yes. Well, then I will begin. Took me back to like play school or something
back in the 80s. School with beer. After a little lie down on the mat afterwards and asleep.
Did you write that whole book yourself, or was that between the two of you, or it was a ghostwriter?
Collaboration between the two of us, yeah.
I think it's about 95% Pete. we worked away at it, but you know, Pete writes all of the blurbs that you see on the beers and
oh right. I was gonna ask that, yeah.
Phenomenal voice, and
I think we make a good team. We had a little incident yesterday, which we're not going to talk about in this podcast. But one of my favorite little tweets was somebody was talking about Garage Project's PR machine, or the PR company they use. It's like there is. I had to laugh out loud. Hey. There is no PR company. It's Joss and me. So.
what I love is how you bring art and design into the whole conversation as well. It's obviously a massive part of what you guys stand for. That new mural on the Wild Workshop is truly awesome. I love it.
It's really fun, isn't it?
Yeah, so cool. Was art and beer always going to be a natural match for you guys?
I think 100%. The actual early concept for 24/24 was 24 different beers in 24 weeks with 24 different artists.
Oh, wow.
And I think from memory, I think we were talking about almost holding it like gallery launches for each one. That kind of went out the window, and we ended up with that sort of stencil spray aesthetic just to keep it easy for the 24. But as soon as we could, in 2012, we started giving beers like Pernicious Weed and Trip Hop their sort of unique art and personality. And, you know, we wanted the beers to be the hero and Garage Project just to be this little group who helps them along the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's worked very well for us. One thing that was, I remember very clearly was a brand expert at the time when we were first getting started was like, "You can't do this, guys." He was just like, "You can't do this. You can't do art like this." He's like, "You know, it's brand suicide. What you need to be able to do is to see the Garage Project logo from 15 feet away. And if you can't do that, it's all fucking over." And we ignored it. And thank goodness we did, because, you know, it's almost become the brand, the art that we use. And we enjoy it. I mean, basically, you know, it's Joss, myself and Tessa work on this, picking artists. Most of them are still local Wellington or New Zealand. Occasionally now we have an overseas artist, but I don't know. It's fun. It's inspiring. It's cool.
I love talking about branding and marketing, being a marketer myself, and love talking about this with you guys. I spoke recently to the guys from Little Bang, who are also art lovers over in South Australia. And when we spoke about branding on the cans and the creation of a master brand that makes it look like they all belong together, they're pretty much like you guys, you know, dead against it and wanted their designs to kind of stand alone as art pieces as well. And it's funny that you just had Scotty from Bolter on the phone. Could you ever see a day where Garage Project might have a core range in a set of, you know, maybe nice white cans with a colour around the edge, or are you going to stick with this whole art thing?
Well, we, you know, we have our classic beer, which is
done it. Yeah.
You know, we actually had a very different logo if you look back to when we started in 2011, that spray aesthetic, and as we moved into starting to do the actual sort of hero beer art pieces. The following year, we realized we needed something a little bit more versatile, which is the logo we have today. So for us, it's just that little mark that can sort of sit across a very wide range of art and styles. And I think for us, that's kind of the cohesion that we see. You know, we have series now. I think if you look at things like obviously the fresh monthly IPAs we do, and that has a consistent sort of lockup across the fresh IPA in the month. But, you know, I think weirdly, a lot of our beers, you group them together. I think arguably what you'd say would be, you know, quote unquote core range of, you know, beer and Happy Days and Gattagista and Pernicious Weed and the like. And
yeah,
they do sort of seem to fit together. It's hard to explain. We don't have that, you know, a la Bolter clean lineup that sort of works together as a unit.
Mm. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that clean lineup, is there? I mean, it works for other breweries. I think it's just just never really felt like us.
No, that's fair enough. I think if you've gone out on that art direction from the start and it's working for you, bloody stick to it, because you are obviously known for that now, aren't you?
Yeah.
How many artists come to you each month pitching ideas for beer can art?
It's quite a continual stream coming in on Instagram or on our website as well. So it's nice, you know, it's great that sort of creativity inspires and sparks more creativity. You know, I think, and we do find once we work with an artist and get on particularly well, we definitely go back time and time again. So we have a number of artists that are responsible for quite a wide range of our beers where you might not realize it. And then I think we probably burn each other out after five or six labels in quick succession.
Speaking of burnout, 450-odd beers on Untappd. Have you run out of ideas, and are you bored trying to create the next great beer?
Well, hopefully we haven't run out of ideas. Fuck.
Well, I hope not.
I think – I don't know. I don't think so. It's always important, I think, to continue to engage with other people and other things. I think, you know, you get burnout when you close off to other things outside, you know, like entropy. You need like fresh energy coming in. So, yeah, touch wood, we haven't run out of ideas. I don't think so.
Well, we do have a beer called Touchwood as well.
We do have a beer called Touchwood, yeah.
I think Pete's right. You know, we've always liked working with chefs or musicians or local artists or groups, festivals. And I think, you know, when you surround yourself with different influences, you're constantly getting these different inspirations coming in. And then, you know, we've got now, I guess within the brewery itself, we've got different places to find inspiration. So, you know, we have the Wild Workshop site now, and we just released a beer this afternoon, which is a sort of a hybrid of hoppy beer and food a sour beer. And so
is that the Harmonic Convergence?
Yes.
Oh, the can art on that is insane, with the, you know, the whales and the purple swirls. Who did that?
It's intentionally kitsch. It always reminds me, you know, in the kind of like early 90s, that new age kind of like sometimes you get art on felt and things like that. It was meant to be a bit of a homage to that. I think it's fucking perfect.
Oh, it's awesome.
Who was the artist? What was the artist's name, Joss?
Yeah. So it's a Weta based artist, Rebecca Titch. So Weta, you know, the Peter Jackson's film production studio, visual effects studio. So we are very blessed in Wellington, fortunate to have a vast creative talent working here who love beer and like drawing pretty pictures.
That's great. And I guess, you know, back on the you know, the beer ideas, where when you run out of your own, that's where all these fantastic collaborations come in for you guys. I was doing, as I said, doing my research, going back through the list to see who the names were. Sierra Nevada, Bolter, Beavertown, Modern Times, Stomping Ground, Other Half Trillium. Need I go on? Like, how do all these things come about? Are these chance meetings at beer festivals, or is it just, you know, as they say, relationships make the world go round, and you've got some great ones out there?
I think Joss is incredibly good at just putting himself and Garage Project out there. He is It's one of his real skills. And, you know, once you make friends, it's an incredibly friendly community, brewing community. So once you do get out there and meet people and just those connections just happen, made some great connections over the years.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, events like Gabs or the Firestone Invitational or sort of even Beavertown Extravaganza, some of these festivals are a great place where, you know, we get to turn up and give people a sort of a taste of what we do, and you get to meet all these interesting brewers and breweries from around the world. And, you know, if you get on and next thing you know, they're sort of interested in working together.
Just, it is interesting. I mean, obviously working with other breweries for collaborations is fantastic, but we've also done like a lot of collabs with non-brewers, and those can be really stimulating as well. So, you know, things like working with, you know, well, we did a collaboration with a producer of potato crisps last year. And we made a potato beer and they made a beer crisp to go with it. I mean, it's just great fun. And it's that thing of bringing some fresh energy in. I mean, that's energy from even outside the brewing community. And I don't know, it's great fun, that kind of thing. We're just finishing off a collab with, you know, a big Wellington-based chocolate producer. So, you know, things like that. The great fun.
Quick question. Did you guys actually head over to Boston to brew with Trillium?
We did, yeah.
You did. The reason I ask is I've been to Trillium Fort Point about 2 years ago with my wife, and it was where I finally got my wife of almost 20 years to take an interest in beer, because she drank one of their, you know, their wild ales that they age in the oak barrels and stuff.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was where she began her beer drinking journey for me, and it's kind of special for me.
Oh, that's fun.
I'm getting teared up here.
That's nice. We should probably send over some Wild Workshop for her then. That'd be awesome.
It's funny. Since then, she tries all the sour beers that I get. She tries them, and 9 out of 10 she loves. Her palate is tuned to that sour
Isn't
thing
that
from
interesting?
All the years of drinking wine and champagne, and that's the stuff she loves, and she loves them more than me.
It's one of the wonderful things about, you know, sour, wild beers like that. They open up you know, a whole new group of drinkers, because not everyone enjoys bitterness in a beer. Yeah. And beer does, I mean, beer is about balance, and obviously bittersweet is one of the ways you can balance a beer. But, you know, I mean, there's also sweet and sour. There's kind of like savory balance you can get using smoke. There's all sorts of things you can do. So it's great to open things up like that.
Moves nicely onto your new release for this month, which was the Random Acts of Kindness. You guys are getting pretty serious about this wild stuff now, aren't you? I mean, I think I read something in one of your articles about your brewer sleeping in a hammock next to the cool ship.
Dave,
and that's
Dave
getting pretty serious.
Dave loves sleeping in his hammock. So we do. We've got Marion Street's been going for probably about 3.5 years.
Yeah.
But it's really just finding its stride now, which is, you know, I mean, we've got now, we're releasing Random Acts of Kindness, but later this year we're going to be releasing Chance, Luck and Magic, which is like a Gerza style. That's the name comes, I have to tell you, from when I worked at Lion, and we used to have to do an HR survey, like a questionnaire that tested your suitability.
You're talking about.
And one of them was that I think I filled it out and it suggested that I had an over-reliance on chance, luck and magic. And I'm like, what? That sounds like the best fucking thing in the world, chance, luck and magic. So I finally managed to produce a beer. So thank you, Lion Nathan, for coming up with that name for me. So chance, luck and magic is like a Gerza style. So 3 years worth of 100% spontaneous sour beer from our cool ship at Marion Street, blended in just the right kind of quantities, and it's pretty special. I think it's really, you know, the pinnacle of what we want to achieve at the Wild Workshop, you know, which is producing beers that, I mean, talk about terroir. You're using the wild yeast and bacteria from the air in that one specific part of Wellington you can't get more terroir than that.
Yeah.
It is the taste of inner city Wellington. I love that it's inner city as well. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people think of, you know, wild beer and sour beer as, you know, people take their cool ships out into orchards or the bush. And I mean, that's wonderful, but I kind of like having it right in the middle of the dirty heart of the city. I think that's
cool. I love it. I've got a mate. I think you guys know Dave Padden from A Car Show. We joke about him. He's in, you know, Five Dock Inner Sydney and him doing a cool ship. And what would he get?
Are you sure?
In his,
I mean,
cool
it's,
ship?
It's, I mean, absolutely.
I mean, you know, we originally, when we were planning the idea of Wild Workshop, you know, we were looking at Martinborough, which is the sort of the wine region, Wairarapa, close to Wellington, an hour or so's drive. And, you know, we're pretty inspired by seeing what Firestone were doing with their Barrel Works program, which is, you know, a good hour clear of their brewery in Paso. And we're like, oh, great, you know, an hour out, wine country. And we just were so busy. It was a real struggle to get out there and actually find sites and get excited by it. And we sort of had this realization one day that, you know, we're an urban brewery. We're in the heart of the city. And, you know, the sort of touchstone for me, at least, for those style of beers is obviously Cantillon, which is in the heart of Brussels. It's a very urban site. And so we said, you know what? It needs to be in the heart of Wellington. And I think that day we found the site.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It was meant to be.
I have quite a few sort of home brewers or, you know, prosumers that listen to these things. And I can just imagine they're losing their mind at this shit right now, because it seems that the whole wild ales thing, and there's quite a few great breweries in Australia doing it, and I've spoken to some in America, and every time I release an episode that starts to talk about wild ales, you just see the numbers just go off the charts. What is it? Is this just like the next evolution for the pointy end that they need to go and chase these wild ales?
Well, if you think about it, it's how beer originally was. I mean, you're getting back to the roots of beer. I mean, this is, you know, people were making, it's how beer would have tasted originally. People had no concept of, you know, yeast or any of these things. So their beers would have necessarily been wild and sour. You basically just sort of, you know, wet your grain, created your kind of like rudimentary wort, and then just prayed. People actually thought that it was magic or divine, you know, divine.
Oh, they had their magic sticks, the magic stirring spoons.
Exactly. Or you just prayed, and it's like, you know, pray to God. Make this happen. And you can imagine when, you know, life would have been pretty brutal and shitty. Can you imagine how just fucking magical it would have been to have had like a beer that made you feel great, even if it was just for a little while? It's so good. It is. It's an act of God. There you go.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I saw, I've mentioned it a few times, but I saw a video one time. This guy's a homebrewer, and his magic stick was a log he found out in the woods in America. And that was his yeast.
Yeah.
And every beer was made with just chucking this log into the wort at the right time.
Yep, absolutely.
Just crazy, crazy stuff. So that's the Wild Workshop. You've got Arlo Street, and then you've got B Studio. I just wanted to sort of touch on the growth of Garage Project and in terms of the kit and the places that you brew, because, you know, it's something that when you start a brewery, often I talk to people that have done it, and they very quickly realize that, oh shit, it's too small. Whether they've got to, you know, increase their kettle size, chuck a few fermenters in, or maybe, you know, go contract brewing or a second site or whatever. I mean, I just want to see what your experiences have been like, because you've pretty much done a bit of everything with that, haven't you?
I think going from the 50 litre pilot system to anything is going to seem enormous. But you know, I think it's funny, if we look at the steps we took, we went from that to a 10 barrel 12 hec system with 6 20 barrel 24 hec tanks, and that was almost a bit of luck that we ended up with that system. It was actually a brewery destined for six string, and at the last moment their site fell through. They had a bylaw passed in the development they were going into banning the production of alcohol by which sort of was a bit of a problem when you'd chosen that site to put a brewery.
Wasn't there like a happy clappy church in the industrial complex, and they did it? I don't know, something awful like that.
You know, we were talking to Premier Stainless up in California, and they said, look, yes, 100%, we can get you a, I think we're looking at a 15 barrel system. Like, yep, you can get it. It's going to take eight to nine months, or you can have a 10-barrel system right now. Yep. And so we went right now. But we never thought beyond that initial installation in terms of expansion, which, I mean, it sounds incredibly naive, but just I think if we thought if we could get that system into that garage and brew on it, it would be a great success. And that would
You say it sounds naive, but that's like a common thread with, I'd say, you guys that have started breweries and that sort of thing, that you think, yep, if we can get that up and running, we will have smashed it. And then all of a sudden, you think, oh, hold on, need a bit more.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been the site at the garage in Arrow has been, I mean, it's been awesome for us in many ways, and we love it dearly, and it really is like our cultural home. But, God, it's a difficult site. I mean, it is right in the middle of, you know, a built-up urban area, houses all around it. Gosh, it would have been easy if we'd been in an industrial site and we could have just like chucked all fermenters in as we grow. But the site is absolutely rammed to the gunnels. Every single tiny little bit of space is utilized for something.
So we managed to we figured out I think within 8 months that, you know, we could swap out that 10-barrel system for a 20-barrel three-vessel system, do double in a day what would sort of take for a whole week of brewing on the old system, squeeze in some taller tanks. I think we have a disproportionately high number of bright tanks, jacketed bright tanks in our packaging hall because it has a very low ceiling in this garage next door. So low that, you know, we managed to squeeze a 60-barrel Bright in there by dragging it on carpet on its side through the, and we had to use a stick to sort of push the roller door up just an inch, and it was a millimeter of light. And we dragged that through and sort of lifted it up. And then eventually we dug out the back of the building, put a pad down, retaining wall, and we craned in 400-barrel tanks, so 120-hect tanks, which is sort of the TARDIS at the rear of Arrow. You can't really tell that it's there, but there's 360-hect of fermenting tank out the back, more than all the tanks in the front that you can see. But as a piece said, it's absolutely jammed, and it's quite remarkable that we can turn out the volume of beer out of that site that we do.
And yet you still needed more.
Still needed more. You know, we sort of got to that that age-old position. I think a lot of breweries of our generation have sort of come up against of needing to expand into that big production site and the sort of challenges that go with it. And, you know, we were at that sort of crossroad, and we were presented with an option of helping establish a production site. We wouldn't own the brewery, but, you know, we could be a foundation customer, and they'd put in some very nice equipment and allow us to continue growing while doing things I think ultimately we felt our fans would enjoy more, things like Wild Workshop, some more cellar doors, and things like the Harpy Research, hop, you know, having our own essentially hop breeding programs, which is the path we've gone down, which has been fantastic. But I think we're definitely in the back of our minds always thinking, you know, we'd like to one day have our own production brewery as well, and possibly put some stainless down in Australia.
Oh, look out. I love getting scoops.
Well, that is something that we would love to do. Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, very good. You heard it here first, peoples. Of course, we were talking about the B Studio then, which was the shared situation that you had. Now, I'm just wondering, was that more than just a place for you to brew the bigger volume beers? Has it been a meeting place for, you know, maybe new collaborations or an inspiration for new ideas? Or have you, as, you know, well-established brewery in New Zealand, then been able to pay it forward with some new up-and-comers through there?
No, I think it's a site that a number of breweries work out of, and that's given them sort of an open road to growth, path to growth, which is as you know, is challenging, especially when you're sort of going from that hump of I guess medium-sized brewery to a large brewery. It's a big jump to make, and that's, you know, when you see, I think, breweries like Pirate Life, you know, it's very easy to get maybe a little overstretched in that step. And then you sort of get into a situation where you know maybe have to partner with someone to help you get through it.
The B Studio sounds like the ultimate sort of place for, you know, it's like a collaborative startup type environment, if you like, in the IT world, where, you know, quite a few brewers can get their start as a bit of a contract brewer. Do you feel like that the whole, I mean, once upon a time, contract brewing, gypsy brewing, whatever, had a real stigma about it, but I've spoken to heaps lately. Do you guys feel like that stigma's starting to be left behind and these kinds of arrangements at B Studio are just a great way for somebody to fulfill their dreams or start to fulfill their dreams?
I think in some ways it probably is. You know, New Zealand, we've always had quite a high number of contract breweries. You know, it's really important when we got started, we wanted to brew 50 litres at a time if it was just that on our own equipment. You know, Pete had a decade of experience in the industry and we could have easily started several thousand litre batches of sort of core range beer to get going. But for us, it was really important to have that, you know, we wanted Absolutely. To be a brewery first and foremost. But, you know, a lot of, you know, some of our contemporaries came down that path and started as contract breweries and then been able to leapfrog into having their own stainless and have grown from there. So I think there's no right or wrong way. If you're making great beer and you've got something to say, people will gravitate towards you.
There's nothing wrong with contract brewing at all for people. I mean, I think my own preference is, you know, always to actually have a brewery as well, simply because I like the brewing process very much. It's you know, it's a great experience. But there's nothing wrong, especially for people to use it as that stepping stone to be able to get where they want to get to.
You're the romantic one between the two of you, aren't you, Pete?
Oh, we're both romantic. What do you mean?
Just the way you speak, it's just the brewing process.
Oh, look, you know, I love it. I think it's fantastic. It really is. And once it gets, I mean, that's the thing about brewing, isn't it? It gets under your skin. I don't think I know of anything else that really, I mean, look, how often do you come across people who have chucked in absolutely sensational careers doing something that earned them loads of money just because brewing's got under their skin and they just, you know, they have to do it. They'll probably never get back to that pay packet that they had when they had that other job. But, you know, it is a passion and it does make people do all sorts of interesting things.
I was talking to a mate this week and I said, some guys swing a golf club, some dress up in lycra and ride a bike, some blokes brew.
Yep.
That's their passion.
Yep. Absolutely.
And if you can do that as a job, you're ahead of 95% of the world, because most of us just have jobs, which is great, pay well, go to work, get your stuff done. But if you can find a job that's your passion, you're never going to work. What's that thing? You're never going to work in a day in your life or whatever it is. Well, you will, but you know what I mean. Hey, so what about the whole the industry and what's going on in New Zealand at the moment? Obviously, you guys have had your COVID lockdowns like we have over here. You know, festivals have been thrown into disarray. I think you've still got Beervana coming up soon, and there's something called the Wellington Street Fiesta. Are those events still going to happen?
At the moment, they will. Beervana's is on as long as we're in what we call level one. So no restrictions. If we move up a level, like Auckland and the rest of the country did recently, that it'll be back off. So we hope it'll be on. We're preparing for it to be on, but we're also keeping the door open.
It's been a difficult year that way. I mean, trying to sort of come up with ideas and commit to things which, I mean, could just vaporize. You know, all it takes is someone to jump quarantine and we'll be buggered. Pretty challenging. Oh, I mean, but, you know, I mean, challenging for everyone this year, hasn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, look, all the online events and stuff that people have been trying to do with, you know, the storytelling, people playing music and lots of stuff.
Yeah.
I imagine for you guys, with how much I can tell you just love this shit, online just isn't the same.
No. And, you know, one of the big things for us at a festival is we love to present and serve beer in different ways that you can only get in that moment at that festival.
Give me some examples. Like how did you
Well, like our traffic light beers, layered beers. I don't know if you ever came across our two-tap flat white inspired by No. Well, you know how you have a flat white coffee? You know, they pour pour the shot of espresso into the bottom of the cup of glass, and then you have your steamed milk, which you kind of pour in and you can make the little pattern. A friend of ours, I think, had just won an award as best flat white creator.
And the champion barista.
Champion barista. And he was just making one in front of us, and I was like, wow. And from that, we created the flat white, which is a shot of just incredibly strong coffee stout. You know, probably more coffee than you wouldn't necessarily want to drink it on its own, but it's this shot of imperial coffee stout in the bottom of the glass. And then we make a cream ale on nitrogen, which we put into one of those milk jugs. And then as you pour it, it pours like frothed milk into the glass. And you can actually, if you do it properly, you can pour pretty little patterns on the top of this thing. And it looks exactly like a flat white or a latte. It's pretty good fun, but very visual, very theatrical. Yep. I mean, you know, we've been racking our brains about how we could try and recreate this in a format that, you know, we could send out to people and they could have it anywhere other than a festival or a bar. But, you know, there's something really cool about that, having to go to a festival to get something like that. I think Joss and I both always felt like people spend a lot of money to get into a beer festival. You know, you want to give them something different, something exciting, something that they can't get, you know, either at home or down the pub on a Friday night. You know, you want a really cool experience.
It's a bit like a musician doing a world tour and not just playing their hits from their CD. Oh, sorry, kids, CDs were before audio players, but not just playing their songs off their CD. They change them up. They do them acoustic. They give them something a little bit extra because that's what they're going to get in that moment that they can't get elsewhere.
Yeah, and a bit of and also if you think about, you know, stadium rock and creating something, you know, far beyond just the music. I mean, think about, you know, a Pink Floyd concert. You know, there's theatre that goes above and beyond what you're actually listening to. It's visual as well. And to be able to bring something like that to a beer festival, I mean, I think punters deserve that.
Josh, I saw a photo of you this week. I don't know what the hell it was. It looked like a big hot poker that you were sticking into beers and steaming up or something. What the hell was that, speaking of theatre in beers?
Just as you say, it was a big hot poker.
I'm amazing.
There you go. Question answer. Tick.
We came up with it in 2013, actually. So a custom hot poker that we could use to flash caramelize strong barrel-aged porter in your glass at a festival. You know, and again, as Pete was saying, that goes back to sort of at a festival, giving people an experience they could only have in that moment, visually and then sensory and the taste and experience of it all, but also actually going back and not having something that's a gimmick or a stunt, and having a little reference to sort of very historical drinks. So you know, we used to have these drinks served in sort of traveling inns called flips, and they were concoctions of ale and egg and spice and all sorts of things that are locked into a mug and then sort of roused up and cooked and stirred up with the hot poker from the fire and sort of knocked back, and then you're on your way again till the next stop. And you know, I think probably didn't take people too long in those times as well to be sitting around the fire drunk and a little bored to sort of look at that poker in the fire and be like, well, what happens if I stick that in my tankard of ale? You know, so we sort of wanted to bring that tradition back and sort of update it.
Ours was just electric. Yep. You could plug it in. So that was the only difference.
Yeah.
Who came up with that idea? Like, who is the ideas guy behind all this stuff? Is it something that you work on together? Have you got a little team of you bringing in the PR team, as you said before, or one of you just like researchers?
I think it's collaborative. It's collaborative. It's Joss and I, and then obviously, you know, the garage is growing. It's a growing far now. You know, we have, you know, there's Dave down at Wild Workshop, who's, you know, just incredibly passionate about wild beer. We've got a great team of brewers, but I mean, you know, a lot of it still comes from Joss and I, you know, working together, collaborating with other people, like I said, outside of GP.
So that's obviously, you know, in the real world when you can do that stuff. But you're doing pretty okay online. As I said before, you know, the story time with Pete was great. I've seen some musicians on your GP Home Facebook page. You've been doing some really great and interesting things. Are any of those things, do you think, going to stick around long term?
I think GP Home is proven to be really popular community now. So, you know, we are seeing that carry on, and we're working to continue to sort of encourage it and support it and run events. You know, I think as you've said earlier, you know, your audience is so passionate, and then having a place for them to sort of come together and connect and share, it creates a very cool environment. So anything we can do to support that and encourage it, we're all for it.
How's the Aussie online shop going for you guys? You launched that earlier this year. I myself have certainly noticed a lot more Aussie beer lovers posting pics of the Garage Project beers on their social media, especially the monthly fresh range.
Yeah, so we've always self-distribute in New Zealand and Australia. You know, we like having that direct contact with our customers and drinkers. And we work very hard for Australia to be a home market, essentially. So it's been challenging this year, but, you know, when we've got a big release, in an ideal world, we like that to be released simultaneously in New Zealand and Australia. Or if we've got big seasonal releases, you know, we'll brew specific batches for Australia months ahead of the New Zealand batch, so we can plan for it to come across and be released day and date. And we've brought that across to the fresh as well. So, you know, we are sort of planning specific brews for Australia so they can come across and be released on the first of the month alongside New Zealand. We don't always get it right. I think the boat broke down this month, and you know, I think we had some port strikes at the other end, and everything that sort of could go wrong did go wrong. But you know, I think, you know, the web store in Australia is going very well. You know, we also love the independent bottle shops in Australia, and you know, I think there's such a strong network of stores in Australia, because, you know, I think maybe compared to New Zealand, we do actually have a lot more freedom, I think, in the supermarkets here to sort of have their own curated beer selections. But, you know, obviously in Australia, we're blown away by the indies and the sheer number of them and the sheer excitement they have for the releases.
It's fair to say they're loving the shit out of you. Because, yeah, we used to get pictures of, you know, like the Happy Days, Pernicious Weed, Garage Easter, all that sort of stuff. But now, you know, there are people that are flexing with their cans, linked to the, you know, when you do the can sitting on top of the glass, you know, on the side, a lot of that sort of stuff with your beers, people are losing their minds over them.
Oh, I think, you know, it's great immediate feedback you get now. You know, we put something out and you really get a sense very quickly if it's resonating and what people are excited by, and that's very cool.
Well, it just replaces the old coasters that you used to have, where you used to get people to write on the coasters their feedback. Are they gone? They're still around?
We've still got them.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we still have them.
I've seen some great photos on that this week. They're awesome.
Oh, they're brilliant. They're lovingly stored in a giant black rubbish bag in the loft of the Wild Workshop.
That's awesome.
You had to have a pretty thick skin at the time because it was.
Did it get a bit nasty?
Oh, well, look, you know, I mean, we were really trying to push the boundaries with those beers. And, I mean, this is the thing with brewing. It's, you know, it's not super difficult to create a beer that will offend nobody. Do you know what I mean? Something that's kind of easy to drink and, you know, no one's going to get upset by it. But if you really push the boundaries, what tends to happen is that you really polarize people. There'll be some people who will love it, like passionately love it. But that, you know, it creates all sorts of passions. You'll also have people who passionately hate it. I mean, Katrina is a perfect example of this. There are people who love that beer. Katrina is the watermelon, rosewater and habanero beer that we release every year for the Day of the Dead. Corn-based lager. It's got watermelon. Talk about balance. It's hot and sweet, which is really, we really love it. A lot of other people love it, like quite passionately. People get tattoos of the Katrina label on their arms. But
Yeah.
By the same token, there are people who loathe it. I mean, we had one. Where was he from, Joss? Was he a Swedish beer writer?
He was. He was. What was his name? Alf Tumble. Ulf Tumble, I think. I can still remember his name.
He tried this beer in Sweden. And what did he write? That he had one mouthful and had to run to the toilet to spit it out. He was not impressed.
The translation was, as soon as it was in his mouth, he wanted it back out.
That's great.
But, you know, I think it's far more exciting to create a beer like that, that, you know, that people are so passionate about at both ends of the spectrum, yeah, than it is to create something that will offend nobody, but nobody will equally remember.
It's funny you mentioned that, and also the coasters. This week I've been teasing on the Facebook page and stuff who my 100th guest was going to be without saying anything. And two of the photos I put up, one was of King Rat demandeth beer, and the other one was a close-up of the Day of the Dead character, and people had couldn't guess them. But I really loved those two images. King Rat demandeth beer. It was awesome, yep, on those coasters. Good stuff. Hey, as I said to you before, I've been playing this chat for quite a while, doing research, you know, writing some questions, getting rid of them, refining them, all that. And I wrote down a question around whether you guys had to shift into more serious roles with the business growing bigger. And I think you sort of touched a little bit on that just then in terms of, you know, the getting the stuff over to Australia with boats and all that sort of thing. And wondering whether that took away some of the joy of what you're doing. But then I went back and rewatched some of Pete's Storytime videos, listening to you guys here. And I feel like that even though that might be part of your role, I still feel like there is just so much joy in the day-to-day of what you guys are doing that I think you could be doing this for a long time yet.
Sorry, I've just Googled that story from, it's 5 years ago, and it's a paywall blocked Swedish website. It's called Dagens Nyheter. But the above the paywall, Google Translate is reflexive vomiting. That's exactly what happened when I tried one of the beers from this.
We should put that on the tasting notes.
And his quote: When are we going to get tired of new kinky beer?
Hopefully not for a little while.
So, is the joy still there for you guys? It sounds like it.
I think, you know, you'd be lying if you didn't say some days were harder than others, obviously. And, you know, as a business grows, obviously it brings all sorts of new demands. But, you know, there are definitely moments, and the passion comes surging back again, you know. Like, I don't know, we've had some, we just did a pickle beer for the burger challenge in Wellington. Every year in Wellington, for Wellington on a Plate, which is a Wellington beer Wellington food festival, there's the Great Burger Challenge. So cafes, restaurants, bars all try and make the most wonderful, outlandish burgers they possibly can. It's this fantastic competition, and everyone in Wellington embraces this and goes out and just eats an absurd number of burgers. And we've supported this how many years now? For ages. How long has it been?
6 years.
Yeah. But each year we release three new beers in can to go along with burgers, so that people can do like beer and burger matches. And you know, look, it was just great. We managed to. It was hectic this year, but we managed to get the three out. We did like an alt beer made with bagels and the mash. We did super low ABV hazy called Noon Juice at 3.5%. And we did a pickle beer, so that tastes like, it's a sour, kettle sour beer that tastes like dill pickles. And it, I don't know, just moments like that when your idea comes together and you're just like, fuck yeah, that's great fun. I don't know. That's when it's all worthwhile.
That's when you think to yourself, I've been kissed on the cock by a fairy. With that, gents, maybe that's a great place to wrap this up. Just absolutely in awe of what you guys have been able to achieve. You're doing some great stuff over there. So glad we're seeing more of it in Australia. As I said to you before we started recording, there's a lot that I don't know about you guys because, you know, of that divide. But now you're starting to come across here. Certainly Australians are really taking to you more and more. Thanks so much for joining me today. Anything in the immediate future that we need to know about, we can tell everybody about?
I think as I sort of hinted at, you know, we have a team in Australia. We have the web store in Australia, but we would love to have a bit more of a home in Australia for our fans to come to.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think once we can actually travel again, once get back out of their houses, our team over there will, you know, we'll be definitely doing what we can to push that along.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. And when the travel bubble opens up between Tasmania and New Zealand, I think you might be seeing me and my family over there because we're keen to get back to New Zealand because I've not done the North Island. I've only done the South, so I've missed out on so much great beer.
Absolutely. Let us know when you're over and we'll say hi.
Thanks, gents. Thank you so much for your time today. I know it's been a massively busy week for you. Just really appreciate your time. And thanks very much. All the best for the future and cheers to great beers.
Cheers, Chris.
Cheers, bro.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have an interesting beer story and want to be a guest on the Beer Healer interviews, send me a message via my Facebook page. And once again, if you want to help out the show, a simple rate and review on Apple Podcasts or a follow, like, or share on any other podcast service will do the trick. I'll catch you soon.